Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
When was the last time you cheated? If you can't remember, you may well have impeccable integrity, more willing to lose out on something than take unfair advantage. But hidden in plain sight among all those ethical souls are people who are okay with cutting corners, skimming off the top, and getting away with what's not right, especially if they believe everybody else is doing it and they won't get caught. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Why should we care about minor league swindles and deceptions? Well, for one thing, the more people who get away with this stuff, the more they assume they're not really doing anything wrong, and the easier it becomes for them to do it again. And next time, the victim could be you. Deborah L. Rohde is Ernest W. McFarland Professor of Law and Director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford University. Her new book is called Cheating: Ethics in Everyday Life. Deborah, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You were surprised to discover there's not a whole lot of scholarly analysis of cheating. Why do you think it's been overlooked as a subject of study?
You know, that's hard to say. What researchers know is what's most notable about analysis of the problem is how little of it there is. And we don't really connect the dots between different forms of cheating and see them for what they represent. So we pay attention when there's a new recent scandal, the huge Wells Fargo fiasco in which over 3,000 employees were caught fabricating customers' accounts. Or we pay attention where health and safety are at risk, sometimes as with auto ignition switches. But for the most part, I think people shrug it off and everyone cheats. Everyone knows everyone cheats at least a little. And that kind of normalization of the behavior is what leads to the escalation that you described. And the result ultimately is our society pays almost $1 trillion annually in losses attributable to cheating and taxes, various forms of fraud, electronic file sharing, the euphemism for copyright violations.
You found, as you said, large percentages of people at least admit privately to cheating in school, on their taxes, in their relationships. How do we rationalize what we know is wrong? At least on some level, we know it's wrong.
Well, there are a variety of ways that people manage to rationalize their own misconduct. Psychologists talk about ethical fading, which is a process in which ethical consequences just recede from awareness. And that's aided by euphemisms and self-serving rationalizations. So cheaters speak of aggressive accounting practices, not evading taxes, sharing music files, not stealing musicians' work. Embezzlers present their theft of funds as a form of borrowing. And I think also what we've learned is that repeated exposure to ethical misconduct can produce a form of ethical numbing. The more that people see others cheat, the less they regard it as cheating. And the more that they follow suit, then the less discomfort they feel. And that's how cheating cultures take roots.
So, Deborah, we have some tolerance in America for what we call white lies. That's, of course, a euphemism in and of itself. But, you know, the situations in which we bend the truth in order to spare somebody's feelings. So we compliment, you know, a friend's haircut when we liked it better before. Are there situations in which cheating might somehow be morally justifiable?
Well, we can all come up with aberrant cases, but, you know, the white lies that we tell as a matter of social politeness is not what's going on in the vast majority of situations that I've just described, where there's real self-dealing involved. And I think it's helpful to think of what ethics experts would use as a framework for thinking about when lies are justified. And they generally say that you have to conclude that a disinterested decision maker would think that the benefits to cheating outweigh the harms, that there are no other alternatives to cheating, and that if everyone in similar circumstances acted similarly, society would be no worse off. So that works for, thank you for a lovely party,
right.
But it doesn't work for the kinds of cheating on taxes, cheating on exams, cheating in sports, cheating in insurance that are the subject of my book.
I know that you are a scholar of law and of ethics, but I wonder if you think there's anything instinctive about the desire to gain an unfair advantage. Is there anything instinctive about the desire to do the right thing, or are they both just things we learn through experience?
Well, I think we all both are socialized to see certain things as inherently unjust and unfair, but we also respond to cues from the social environment in which we work or study. So people's views of what's ethical often depend on how they perceive the behavior and values of those around them, peers and leaders of organizations. And when people see everyone else cheating and getting away with it, it creates a normalization of conduct. And oftentimes that kind of normalization of cheating is so gradual that we don't even realize it. We cross lines through a series of minor decisions that we don't really even think about thoroughly. As one architect of a Ponzi scheme put it, well, I didn't set out to steal hundreds of millions of dollars. He just kept crossing ethical lines and couldn't find a way to go back. And this is what psychologists sometimes term the boiled frog problem.
Mm-hmm.
Legend has it that the frog is going to jump out of boiling water, but if you put the frog in a pot of tepid water and gradually heat it, the frog will calmly boil to death. It turns out the folk wisdom is wrong about frogs, but right about humans. And it's these small incremental acts of cheating that enable people to engage in larger acts that are contrary to their own values without oftentimes really realizing what they're doing.
So to the extent that you write about cheating as at least partially the product of opportunity, what conditions facilitate cheating?
Well, a lot of cheating is a response to the reward structure that people find themselves in. So one reason why you see so much cheating on taxes between 40% and 50% of returns have some understatement of income, according to most research, is that the penalties are so low and the risks of detection are even lower. Only 2% of returns are audited. And even when the evasion is detected, often the sanctions are fairly minimal. If we increased funding for tax audits, we could recover about 60 times the cost of the additional oversight. But because so few Americans like the IRS, they're not going to fund enforcement structures that would, in fact, save honest taxpayers billions.
So contrary to popular perception, cheating is not necessarily attributable to some fixed character flaw, is what you discovered. It's really like we see that we can do it, we see that we can justify it to ourselves. That would suggest, I would imagine, that cheaters can be reformed, that it's not a permanent state of someone's personality to be a cheater.
Absolutely. I mean, what psychological studies suggest is that maybe 10% of the population is, pretty much incorruptible across all contexts. And about 10% are habitual cheaters, and most of the rest of us fall somewhere in between. And we respond to cues in our environment about what's ethically justifiable and what the likelihood of detection and serious sanctions will be.
Most of us fans would say that we disapprove of cheating in sports, but I'm curious about how the win-at-all-cost mentality that we expect of athletes might be weakening their resolve to compete fairly.
Well, we say that we're against it in sports, and we trot out platitudes about good sportsmanship at banquets, but what do we actually reward? And, you know, you find, for example, that athletes that have committed serious offenses, for example, doping, may be suspended for a number of games. But then, as recently happened with one baseball player, just 2 months after the suspension, he was rewarded with a $16 million contract renewal, the largest in his career. Lance Armstrong was stripped of his titles, but he still walked away with $100 million. And so people see that cheating sometimes pays off, not just in professional athletics, but, you know, in sort of daily sporting contests. 80% of executives acknowledge that they cheat in golf. And Arnold Palmer once remarked that the easiest way to shave points off your score was through an eraser. Even presidents cheat at golf. They're notorious examples, including once by our current incumbent, who, as one journalist who played a game with him described it, he's 11 on a scale of 1 to 10 for cheaters.
So we haven't seen President Trump's tax returns, or not very much of them, and he doesn't feel that he is required. In fact, there is no law to require him to disclose those. But he has indicated that if he didn't pay as much as other people with similar income, it's because he's smart. That's not a direct admission of cheating, but it certainly suggests that, you know, finding any way possible to pay less is a good thing to do. Do those examples matter to us? Do we take cues from people who we consider to be very important or admirable or in positions of power?
Absolutely. And I think the election of Donald Trump is a kind of case study in public indifference. You know, running up to the election, there were a drumbeat of disclosures about his fraud, his illegal self-dealing, his stiffing contractors, little workers in his organization, students in his university. And none of it seemed to dislodge popular support. Only a third of Americans thought that Trump was honest and trustworthy, and 63 million people voted for him anyway. I think that just speaks volumes about the lack of priority that we place on honesty and character in public life. And it has corrosive consequences.
Do you think most people believe that people who are honest finish last?
Enough people believe that if they cheat a little, they'll get an edge. And that's what matters, especially since those small acts of cheating make larger acts and repeated acts more easy to accept. And, you know, people have what psychologists call cognitive dissonance. When they do something that's inconsistent with their values, they figure out a way to recharacterize their behavior so that it doesn't violate ethical norms. And so we reduce the distance between our idealized self and our actual behavior by a variety of techniques. We say, well, the victim was responsible. No one was seriously hurt. Everyone else does it. And so, you know, people rationalize file sharing of music as costs falling on wealthy record companies rather than on starving musicians. Or in my profession, one reason padding bills is so common is that 90% of lawyers believe that other lawyers do it, at least occasionally.
My guest is Deborah L. Rohde. She's professor of law and director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford University. Her new book is called Cheating: Ethics in Everyday Life. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Deborah L. Rohde. She's professor of law and director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford University. Her new book is called Cheating: Ethics in Everyday Life. You can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Okay, Deborah, why do you think cheating is so rampant in education these days?
Well, we know that somewhere around 80% of students will admit cheating in high school, and a compilation of surveys finds that the average rate of reporting cheating across schools is about 70%. But some of those same studies find that 92% of students are nonetheless satisfied with their ethics and integrity. They don't consider it a major problem, and many institutions don't treat it as one. The rate of apprehension of cheating is about 3%, and the sanctions are often quite minor. Unless we start taking it more seriously, beginning in elementary school, and give many more clear signals to students about what constitutes plagiarism from the internet, I think we're going to find a whole generation of individuals who just don't understand the boundaries of what constitutes academic misconduct.
This one's really challenging because, and I want to make it clear that I do not condone cheating in school, but if it's true that 80% of students are cheating, the 20% who aren't truly are at a disadvantage.
Well, absolutely, which is why 80% cheat. Mm-hmm. If you think it's the only way you can get ahead and that the game is rigged, then why not do it at least a little? And also, I think there are, for many students, enormous competitive pressures to cheat. Parents inadvertently reinforce a mindset that takes honesty less seriously than is appropriate. They'll, quote, help their kids by doing the homework or assignments. Encourage the kids or put pressure on the kids to get high grades and reward performance rather than effort. So kids feel enormous pressure. You see rampant cheating among college athletes because many are unprepared for the academic part of the university. They weren't recruited because of an interest or ability to perform at the level that they're expected to perform. And so the only way to hold on to their scholarships is by finding tutors who will help them through the tough patches. So I think unless we really rethink how often we're prepared to report cheating and take it seriously, we're not going to be able to reverse the mindset that gets inculcated in students at very early ages that a little bit of dishonesty is okay.
Is there a way to take away the sort of life or death stakes that are attached to things like grades and standardized test scores these days?
Well, I think, that horse has left the station, or train has left the station. It's not something that we're going to be able to reverse. We live in a competitive culture. But what all of the studies on childhood learning and psychological health suggest is that the best thing you can do is praise kids for effort, not performance. And if they have the view that through their own honest hard work, they can achieve adequately, that's the mindset that's going to serve them well over the long term. It may not satisfy their parents on this particular test, but that's what predicts success over the course of a career, is the belief that honest hard work can make a difference. And perseverance and grit in the learning process and valuing learning for its own sake, not just for extrinsic rewards like grades, is what really motivates high achievers.
I'm really interested in all these justifications that we give ourselves for cheating. One is to say that we did this for the benefit of somebody else, right? So I cheated on my taxes so I'd have more money to take care of my family. We can suddenly frame this thing that we have done as a moral rather than immoral act.
Well, and that's why you need to subject it to that test that I described earlier. Would a disinterested decision maker consider that to be an adequate justification if everyone did in similar circumstances? You know, where would we be as a society if everyone said that about taxes? I could use this money better than the government could.
So
I think we all believe that on some level, but we all recognize that if everyone acted on that perception, you know, we wouldn't have roads and, you know, safety, food safety services and national security and everything else that our taxes pay for.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we tell ourselves, you know, we're justified in cheating because the system is somehow unfair. And again, not wishing to justify this, I wonder if, you know, if people in charge of rules and policies and prices did a better job communicating why things are the way they are, might we see less cheating?
Well, I think in some context, that's clearly the answer. And, you know, some countries have found that reminding people of all the good things that their taxes do is helpful. Also, getting people to sign forms before they fill them out, attesting to their honesty, is like a moral reminder. And that helps. I think also in some contexts, and we're seeing this, for example, with electronic file sharing, downloading music, that we really probably do need to rethink the legal norms of how we define ethical copyright violations, because they're just unworkable in their current form. And other countries have found ways to pay musicians by levying, for example, a small fee on users that are much more effective in getting the money to the musicians or to the artists than this kind of whack-a-mole game that some big companies have been playing in, trying to put draconian fines on people who are engaged in what it turns out, you know, most young Americans are engaged in.
Most of us are really outraged if we are the victim of someone else having cheated. But we have a harder time when we're not the victim. You know, it came up around our conference table. Many people have had the experience of knowing that a friend is being unfaithful to his or her spouse. It's not always an easy decision to march over and inform the spouse of what's happening.
Well, yes, and I don't think that that's the right response to marital cheating. And, you know, it's an interesting case. 90% of people think that cheating and adultery or extramarital relationships are wrong. And that figure is higher than it was several decades ago, even though we've liberalized our attitudes towards other forms of sexual behavior. And I think one reason why people continue to have that strong view is that, you know, you've now got an alternative to cheating in marriage, you know, divorce. But in many cases of marital cheating, and it's estimated that somewhere around a fifth of men and a slightly smaller percentage of women do engage in those relationships, it's not the end of the relationship. And that it's not symptomatic of a breakdown in the relationship. It's much more a product of, you know, a set of circumstances that may be open to change. And lots of people manage to work through those concerns. And therapists themselves often don't see cheating as the worst form or the most likely form of behavior that leads to marital breakdowns. So, you know, I don't think it's up to third parties to go around informing on other people's marital infidelity. But I think there's a lot of folks who are engaged in extramarital relationships that are deluding themselves about the degree to which their behavior might harm their partner or their children.
I want to talk more about this term that you mentioned. I think it was ethical numbing. Does it get easier to cheat after we've done it once because we didn't get caught, or because it's just something we're used to? We're used to putting aside that uncomfortable feeling that we have done something wrong and should feel guilty.
Both. Mm-hmm. And what tends to happen is you can see it. For example, people who cheat on their expense reports or their bills, they just get used to doing it. It just becomes part of the process. And because they're only doing it a little, they're not paying attention to the likelihood that the behavior is going to escalate, both in amount and frequency.
What's the relationship between stealing and cheating? Because lots of people, you know, I always think about this, people who wouldn't think of stealing something from a store effectively steal when they don't represent their entire income on an income tax form, but somehow it feels different.
Yeah, well, part of the reason why you see music file sharing, electronic file sharing, is so much more frequent than, say, shoplifting a CD from a record store, as if there were many of those left, is because people think of stealing as physical property, taking it off the shelves. And in fact, there are lots of ways to misappropriate people's real property, and increasingly a lot of that is happening online.
My guest is Deborah L. Rohde. She's Ernest W. McFarland Professor of Law and Director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford University. We're talking today about her new book. It's called Cheating: Ethics in Everyday Life. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Deborah, what can you tell us about effective ways to punish cheating when someone is caught?
Well, I think one clear message from the book is that we need to significantly increase sanctions. One survey found that of 600 alleged offenders who were referred to the Justice Department, only 84 of these white-collar offenders ended up with any jail time. And oftentimes, even when they do, the penalties are relatively light and much smaller than for street crime. The Wells Fargo CEO, who survived the most recent scandal with $130 million in compensation, he lost his job, but certainly he didn't suffer anything close to a significant penalty, despite the costs that were visited on customers. And we need to change that, to give people a different message. And oftentimes, I think organizations have to look at their own reward structures and how their own compensation systems might inadvertently encourage cheating. I give a classic illustration in the book of Sears Robot, which once changed its compensation system for auto repair mechanics to rely less on the hours they worked and more on the commissions for the services they performed, whether they were needed or not. And it could have been predicted there was massive fraud. Suits were filed in over 40 states, and even David Letterman had a comedy segment on the top 10 repair jobs, including grease the ashtrays or add a redwood deck. So we need to do that. And we know that for every dollar we spend, for example, trying to detect insurance fraud, we get back $8 in savings. So we need to invest more in sanctions.
So there is stigma against cheating, but reading this book made me realize there's even greater stigma against people we perceive to be what the words are like, tattletale, narc. We have a real problem with somebody who, in our perception, sticks their nose into something that they weren't involved in and gives up someone who has been cheating.
Yeah. Well, and that stigma against informers is what really makes so many people reluctant to be whistleblowers, even in contexts where health and safety is at risk. And we really need to change that cultural message. And occasionally we make efforts to do that. Time magazine, after the Enron scandal, over a decade ago, put on its cover some of the whistleblowers in that case. But for too many of them, it's perceived as career suicide. And we just have to change those cultural messages. So many of those individuals really are putting their own livelihoods at risk by telling people about massive frauds and sometimes health and safety violations. That's how we've learned about a lot of the misconduct. It's how we learned about what tobacco executives knew about the health risks of cigarettes. Those were whistleblowers. And we need to recognize and value their contributions in circumstances where health, safety, and huge consumer savings are at issue.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Michael calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, my question is, I was hearing earlier that the train, so to speak, for education and standardized testing and cheating that happens in there has already left the station. I was wondering, because that kind of got passed over, I was wondering what, if any, solutions are there or strategies that we can employ to address that.
To stop cheating in schools?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, well, we have a pretty good sense of what works, and some of the obvious things are reducing the possibilities that misconduct will go undetected. So you can set up testing procedures with more monitors, keep seats removed, make sure that people don't have electronic devices. You can give clear instructions about what is and is not appropriate use of the internet. You can encourage teachers who suspect or are pretty sure that cheating has occurred to use the honor code violation process. Relatively few now do so, in part because they view it as ineffective and requires them to jump through too many hoops. And the result is that too much cheating goes unpunished. And when people see that others are getting away with it, that just increases their willingness to engage in it themselves.
Deborah L. Rohde is my guest. She directs the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford University and is author of Cheating, Ethics in Everyday Life. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Deborah L. Rohde, who is Ernest W. McFarland Professor of Law and Director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford. Her new book is called Cheating, Ethics in Everyday Life. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org. We have a really interesting question here from Philip, who writes, I try to find ways to cheat when I play video games, but only if it's against a computer and not other players. Does this seemingly harmless cheating I do make me more susceptible to other forms that might hurt me or others?
Well, I have no idea. We'd need to do some research. I think when there really are no victims, you're not just deluding yourself that there are no victims, it probably doesn't translate into other contexts in which people's are harmed by the behavior. That would be my intuition, but we'd probably need to run the numbers.
It's funny that for any of us, winning by cheating still can feel good. You know, my sister and I have laughed about playing Monopoly for hours as kids, and I think there were times when both of us were cheating. And knowing this, you still wanted to win. Is there a way to sort of make ourselves realize that it doesn't count if we haven't gotten there honestly?
Well, I think that's a kind of message that you want to send in any circumstance that has real-world consequences. Mm-hmm. I don't know that cheating on board games is where I would put my major energy. My suspicion is a lot of folks do it. But what you really do want to clamp down on are the people who find rewards from the risks of cheating and not getting caught. And that defines why some people engage in shoplifting, even though they are not in economic need, or why people joyride in cars. It's the thrill of getting away with it. And that is a form of reward that can be really corrosive when it translates into situations that can cause real injury to others.
How would you respond if a friend or a neighbor confessed something that maybe didn't have a human, a sort of direct human victim, but said, like, you know, I siphon electricity off the neighbor's connection or something? What's the right way to respond to that if we disapprove? Because I think many times we have this sense that it would be impolite to say, hey, that's completely not okay.
Well, I think one of the main messages of the book is that ordinary Americans need to take more responsibility for fostering ethical behavior in the context where there are pressures to cheat. And that means not only subjecting our own conduct to more demanding standards, but calling out and trying to prevent misconduct in others. And I think sustaining a culture that effectively discourages cheating as a kind of collective obligation, and one in which we all have a substantial stake. And how best to do that really does depend on the context and the relationship that you have with a neighbor and so forth. And every circumstance calls for somewhat different tactics. But I think you pick what you think is most likely to be effective. And usually that's not being preachy, but it's just reminding the person that, gosh, if everybody did that, where would we be?
All right. We'll go back to the phones now. Kevin is calling from Benbrook. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Great show today. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm a college instructor, and I started teaching again about 6-7 years ago after having spent the previous 25 years in business. And I was a TA back in the 80s. I have a lot more plagiarism amongst my students now than back in the 80s, and maybe it's just that it's easier to catch. I'm not sure, but every single course I've taught since starting back at teaching, I've had at least one student commit not just accidental plagiarism, but willful copying of work that wasn't their own. So I warn them at the start of each class. I give them my phone number and say, look, if it's the night before and you can't get it done, I'm your 1-800-DO-NOT-PLAGIARIZE hotline. But yet I still have this, constant plagiarism going on. And I'm hoping you have some suggestions as to how I motivate students not to cheat.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that some forms of cheating have increased, including plagiarism, because it's just so much easier. Students can lift things off the internet. You know, they can buy entire term papers. You know, they can even buy term papers on plagiarism. we've made it really easy to cheat, and so we have to make it really much harder for cheaters to get away with it. And part of it is doing what you're doing, which is sending a clear message that it's not okay. Using plagiarism detection services, you know, you can use software now to try and pick up some of it. And I think, and here's where we know that most faculties sort of fall down in the task, it's actually reporting the students who are guilty of the misconduct. Most professors just don't want to go to that extra trouble of invoking the honor system, and they engage in a form of rough justice. So they'll decrease the grade, or they'll make the student do it over. But you don't catch serial offenders that way, and there's no way to escalate the penalties to really send the message. And so we've just got to, as faculty members, be more willing to invoke what's at times a really not user-friendly process in order to send appropriate messages. And, you know, curiously, some universities themselves are just so lax in the systems that they set up for these honor code violations. Somebody even found that Oregon University's manual on plagiarism was plagiarized from Stanford's. You know, what were they thinking?
All right. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Toby in Richardson. Hi, Toby.
Hi. I think you touched on this a little, but I was curious what you think about this. I think that no matter how good an example your parents set or your school gives you or neighbors that you know give you, I don't think the people in our country are going to stop cheating in so many ways until they get a good example from our government, which I think to many people they realize the government cheats in some ways. Why should we not cheat? I just don't think it's going to ever change.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Deborah?
Well, you know, seeing people at high levels get away with it for sure is a part of the way that you have corrosive cultures. But I think, you know, sometimes they don't get away with it, and that sends a message too. I mean, we just had a number of high-level members of the Trump administration forced to resign because they'd abused government privileges, you know, took fancy jets, and didn't disclose ties that they had with Russia. So, you know, when you see people losing their jobs and having their reputations seriously compromised, that can send a message as well. And we just need to be much more effective and consistent in sending those messages, because the caller's right. When you see leaders getting away with it, it just sends absolutely the wrong signal.
Do you think narcissism plays a role? Like the idea that the rules are fine for everyone else, but they clearly weren't meant to apply to you and me.
Absolutely. And we have studies that show it, that people in positions of power are more likely to cheat. Leona Helmsley famously said, you know, paying taxes is for little people, landed her in prison. But that sense of entitlement that goes with a narcissistic personality also does tend to predict a higher likelihood of cheating.
All right, back to the phones now. This time we have Don calling from Dallas. Hi, Don.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is, are there aberrant subcultures which so set the reward-punishment structure that virtually set up a system that virtually precludes any success through honest behavior? I'm thinking of the example of Wells Fargo, where it seems like virtually all of the people who were not fired put set up accounts that were bogus.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good illustration of a very skewed reward structure. And it was very difficult to make your quotas at Wells Fargo if you didn't engage in this kind of activity, which is why so many employees ultimately lost their jobs. And the people to really fault there are the managers and the leaders who set unrealistic quotas at the outset. And even when they had reason to believe that there was massive cheating, did nothing to detect it and sanction it. And you saw the same thing happening in Enron. They had a kind of rank and yank reward structure where people who didn't make their numbers lost their jobs. And, you know, that just sets a company up for fraudulent conduct.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There was a time, Deborah, when, for example, when I was a kid, prices were stamped on things with like a little piece of paper, you know, a sticker that had the price. And then we moved to UPC code so that people couldn't switch those around. I wonder if technology will ever get all the way out in front of cheating.
Well, I'm dubious. You know, we're an inventive beast, and we find new ways to cheat. So just as technology has made it possible to detect some, it's opened the way for others. And the plagiarism and electronic file sharing are good examples. That's a form of cheating that wasn't available earlier. So. I think that we're never going to be able to curb the behavior entirely through technology. What we can do is try to harness it in ways that enable us to be more effective in detecting it.
I'm really curious about the response that you've had to this book, because certainly I think anyone who reads it will really be moved to do some self-reflection, like, have I cheated and yet justified that behavior? But I can't imagine you're hearing from too many people who are happy to tell you, yes, Deborah, I realized I've been cheating for years.
Yeah. Well, I'm not expecting that kind of a response to the book, although I must tell you that writing the book made me really self-conscious. You know, like, is there any possibility I have ever inadvertently lifted something? I just, you know, I thoroughly examined my own life. And, you know, what you find if you do that for most of us is not an entirely unblemished record. But if the book prompts people to do that, I don't need them to share it with me. I just want them to have more insight into what caused the behavior, how they can prevent it, and most importantly, how they can socialize their children and create organizational structures that don't encourage the behaviors that they're not proud of.
I wonder sometimes if we have somehow sent a message in our society that we don't value honesty anymore.
Well, I think we should for sure send that when we reward those who clearly don't make a high priority of honest behavior. And, you know, the election of Donald Trump is just a classic instance.
All right. Let's very, very quickly here go back to Ray in Mesquite. Ray, I can give you about 20 seconds to ask your question. Okay, we will move on to Eric. Eric, 15 seconds to ask your question.
Hi. So basically, what I've seen as an interesting theory for why people cheat is that sometimes what they see themselves as is sort of a force of natural selection, and that what they're doing whenever they cheat is they're punishing someone for an unwanted degree of trust. They see themselves as kind of taking advantage of weakness that deserves to be exploited.
So fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, fool me twice, shame on you, that kind of thing. I've got it mixed up, but you know what?
Yeah, I get it. Well, for sure there's a phenomenon that I discuss in the book, retaliatory cheating. When people feel their organizations have been unfair to them, that encourages them to engage in cheating behavior. So whether it's pilfering office supplies or forging, you know, expense reports. So I think one thing that organizations can do to remove incentives for cheating is make sure that they've created a climate, not just that rewards honesty, but that also treats employees fairly.
Deborah L. Rohde is professor of law and director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford University. Her new book is called Cheating: Ethics in Everyday Life. Deborah, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us.
Thanks so much for caring about this topic.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle is @KERAThink. You can find the podcast and learn more about the show by going to think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.